Transportation, January the 24th, 2005 to order. Welcome all of my members that whom are here.
Glad to have you back.
Yes, it's nice to be here. Thank you for moving everything for me so that I could have a little illness on the way. One of the things that we didn't do before, and I would like for the committee members who are here to introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your connection to transportation and what you've done in the past, or if not that, if you haven't been involved in transportation, the reasons that you are happy to be here. So let's start with you, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Senator Bruce Starr. I represent Western Washington County, the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Plains. And transportation is something that I've focused on in my work in the legislature, and I've chaired the House Committee on Transportation and vice chair last session with Senator Metzger on the Senate Transportation Committee. And transportation is important to me because it's important to my constituents and the businesses that I try to operate in the area of the state that I represent, and congestion issues are ones that seems to be a big problem out our way in Western Washington County. I'd invite you to try to get to Hillsborough either early in the morning or late in the afternoon any day of the week, and you'll understand the challenges that not only do my constituents, but the businesses that manufacture a lot of chips, little chips, not the ones you eat, but the ones that power a lot of electronic equipment around, as they try to get those chips to the Port of Portland or other places to get them to market. So that's why I'm here, and I appreciate the opportunity to serve with you, Madam Chair. I'm looking forward to a productive session.
Thank you very much. All right. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Senator Verger. Rick Metzger, and I have been serving on the Transportation Committee for the last three sessions as Vice Chair in 01, the Senate Transportation Chair last year, serving with Senator Starr, and pleased again to be here under your leadership, Madam Chairwoman. Again, as Senator Starr mentioned, transportation is very big in my district, each of Clackamas County, Hood River County, I-84, and Highway 26. And as Senator Starr talked about the congestion because of all the employment out in his district and the traffic it causes, all the people that work there live in my district, and they take 205 to get there. So we have this link, but it's not exactly a productive one. So it is important, very important to my district.
Thank you. All right. Senator Whitsett.
I'm Senator Doug Whitsett from District 28, Klamath, Lake, Jackson, Deschutes, and Cook Counties, or parts thereof. I'm a retired veterinarian, farmer. I have no experience in government affairs, for that matter. But I am particularly interested in transportation as an economic development tool and a job creation tool throughout the state of Oregon, and particularly in rural areas.
Thank you, and I welcome Senator Whitsett as my vice chair during this session. Look forward to working with him. I think that we don't always need everybody on a committee to have a lot of depth of experience. We need somebody that's going to bring their experience to it and bring a balance to the committee as we talk about real life in rural Oregon, and you can certainly do that, and I greatly appreciate that. I'm your chair, and I'm Joanne Verger, and I was on transportation in the first session, in the House session in 01, and served in the interim. And my husband and I have been in the automobile business for a long, long time. So transportation was kind of a first cousin for us. And I'm very, very happy to be back serving on transportation as a new senator, and look forward to chairing this committee as we move forward in learning how we can create a more competitive economic development environment in Oregon through our ports and marine and airports. And so for these first meetings, what we've been doing is just gaining information as to where we are today and what does Oregon look like and what do we need to change it and to make it better. And committee members, you all received a copy of the committee rules. Do I hear any changes to committee rules, any deletions, corrections? If not, the committee rules are adopted. Pardon me? Next, I would like to call up Charlie Reardon, who is with our State Transportation Department, and also Michael Burrell. Michael is the chair of the State Aviation Board, and we're very happy to have both of you here today.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Charlie Reardon. I'm the acting director of the Oregon Department of Aviation.
And I'm Michael Burrell. I am the new chair of the State Aviation Board. I have my first meeting as chair of the board this week.
Good.
And what I have is I just have a general overview of the Oregon Department of Aviation and the airports in the state of Oregon. And I'll get this PowerPoint fired up here and go through it.
I might add, Madam Chair, that today is a very busy day, too, because we're interviewing for the position as director of the Department of Aviation. So we have three interviews going on this afternoon, and I'm involved in that also. So I'm going to be slipping out of here with your blessing, if that's okay, after we get started.
Before you leave, though, why don't you address the committee before Charlie gets started? Just a little bit about what you do and what you plan, what you see for the future.
Well, in my personal life, when people ask me that question, I normally say I don't know, but I'm very busy. What we do as a family is we do real estate development, real estate sales. And because of that, transportation is extremely important to developing any type of real estate in the state of Oregon. So probably close to half of my time is spent on transportation issues. I do work very closely with the Oregon Department of Transportation as well as with the Aviation Department of Aviation. And one of the items that I felt very strong about when aviation was taken out of ODOT was the need to have that relationship still be there, because we can't pretend that aviation is not part of the transportation system in Oregon. It is a very vital part of it, and we can't have aviation work in one direction and ODOT work in another direction and not be talking to each other. And so part of my passion is to make sure that we have that relationship, and I work very hard at that. I have been on the aviation board since its inception, so I've been there for 4 years, and I was just appointed as chair. I was reappointed to the board. We're going through as a department some trying times right now. We have been without a full-time director now for several months. We had an acting director that was with us up until, I believe, November. Charlie, that's with us to present today, has never done this before, and he is kind of an acting director because he has a full-time position in the department, but he has not been a director of the department before. So he's learning as he goes along, and I'm learning and working with him. But I spent some time with him earlier today, and he's put together a very good presentation that I know will help you to understand what the Department of Aviation does and what our mission is in Oregon and what we see as our goals and our objectives as we go ahead.
Thank you, and I am so appreciative of people who take the time and to come and to help us become more informed, because the only way that we can make really good decisions is that we have all of the information at hand. All right, Charlie?
Okay, thank you. The mission of the Oregon Department of Aviation is to maintain a statewide system of airports in Oregon that provide a safe aeronautical transportation system that fosters economic opportunities through the efficient movement of people, goods, and services. Just like the Department of Transportation, we have a high priority of safety in the state, of maintaining our airports and helping the pilots be as safe as we can and provide pieces of infrastructure as far as the airports go, so that they are safe for the traveling public as we can make them. A little overview of our department. We have a staff of 16 full-time employees. Actually, we have 16 full-time employee positions. We have currently two vacancies. As Mike indicated, the director is currently vacant, and the pilot position is currently vacant. I will say that everybody that works for the Oregon Department of Aviation is they're highly motivated, and they're truly dedicated to the aviation industry. Everybody that finds their way into the aviation field, just for some reason, aviation is in their blood, and they love working there. And I could say that all the people that I work with in that department have that level of professionalism towards aviation. State Aviation Board. The Oregon Department of Aviation Board is a 7-member volunteer citizen board appointed by the governor with the consent of the Oregon State Senate. The chairman, Mike Burrell, is from Medford. Jack Lowacker is from Portland. Carrie Novak is the airport manager in Redmond. Steve Schreiber is the vice chairman from the Port of Portland. Steve Beckham is from Almsville. And Amy Prutzman is our newest member from the community of Bend. We currently have one vacancy on the board. Our budget activity in fiscal year 2003-05, we had revenues of $16 million and expenditures of $14 million. Those funds come from other funds. $8.5 million comes from the other funds category, and $7.5 million comes from the federal government. Our budget activity for the 2005-07, we anticipate having revenue of $19.3 million and expenditures of $17.6 million. Out of that, $8.8 million comes from other funds and $10.5 million from the Federal Aviation Administration. An overview of the state of Oregon and the airport system. All of these airports are public use airports. There are 98 of them. With the airplane on the map or chart, those are the airports with scheduled airline service. In the state of Oregon, we have 453 airports. Out of those 453, 355 of those airports are private airports. That is, you have to have permission from the owner to land there. It's on private property. The remaining 98 are public use airports. Of the public use airports, 32 of those airports are owned by municipalities. 28 are owned by state, the Oregon Department of Aviation. 10 of them are owned by ports. 9 are owned by county governments. 5 are owned by other government bodies like Bureau of Land Management, Parks and Recreation Departments. And 8 are privately owned. A term that the FAA uses is called NPIAS, and I don't know how they get NPIAS out of that, but NPIAS, and it stands for the National Plan of Integrated Airport Systems. A reason that this term is important is because in the NPIAS, you have to be a NPIAS airport in order to be eligible for federal airport improvement funding. And the FAA provides funds at the ratio of 19 to 1. That is, for every dollar the state or a local government spends on airport-related projects that are eligible, the federal government comes in with $19. Out of the 98 public-owned airports in the state, 41 are non-NPIAS and 57 are in the NPIAS. And what that means is that 57 of the airports in the state of Oregon are eligible for federal dollars. In the year 2003, the FAA gave $39.1 million of federal dollars to the NPIAS airports in the state. 7 of the airports have scheduled airline service, and they collected $27.9 million in passenger facility charges at those airports. So a total of $57 million of federal dollars.
Senator Prezant.
Hi, Charlie, could you please tell us how one an airport becomes a NPIAS classified?
Madam Chair, Senator Prezantsky, you become a NPIAS airport by importance in the state, in the national system. Mostly it is by size of airport, either activity-based aircraft at the airports, or if it is not purely the size of the airport with the based aircraft, our activity occurring at the aircraft, it is of geographic importance. We have an airport that the FAA will give federal dollars to that we'd like to get built in Jordan Valley. The FAA will designate that a NIPIUS airport because it is the last area in the state of Oregon that does not have an airport capability. So from a geographic location, it's one of the ways, but 99% of the time it's based upon annual operations, takeoff and landings, or based aircraft.
Thank you.
Follow up?
No.
Nope. All right. Any other questions? All right. Continue on.
Some of the responsibilities we have, the Oregon Department of Aviation, we operate, manage, and maintain 28 state-owned airports. So the state of Oregon, we run from Salem 28 airports. I think we have leased property. We have 294 leases, and we have it's quite a challenge from Salem to run 28 airports. We have we register pilots and we register aircraft in the state. We do aviation planning work, airport master plan updates, system plan updates, and economic impact studies. We do land use planning and zoning controls to help controlled growth around airports that would impede aviation activity or aircraft traffic. We have a tall tower program with all the cell phone towers going on up and other tall towers as they're constructed. We review those so to determine that they don't have an impact on the aviation activity or the safety of the traveling public by air. We manage airport improvement project and infrastructure development projects. In order to we have three funding programs for airport improvement projects. We have financial aid to municipalities, federal non-primary entitlement program. We have a statewide airport pavement maintenance program. And the federal aid to municipalities program, in the 2003-2005 year, we had $650,000. 23 airports were awarded projects of $230,000 in 2003-2004. And in 2004-2005, $420,000 in projects went to 25 airports. The projects are awarded in grants of up to $25,000. It's based upon the size of the community to determine what their match is, up to 50%. So a smaller community would give a match of 5%, and a larger community with more resources would give a match of 50%. In the 2004-2005 year, we had applications in excess of $500,000 that went unfunded. We have a non-primary general aviation entitlement program. In the year 2000, the Federal Aviation Administration came to our department and asked us to manage airport improvement projects in the state of Oregon. In 2001, we had five airports in the project for $589,000, and it has grown to 30 airports with $2,900,000 is what we expect this year. What we do is we manage the projects. They can be at airports, so the Newport, Salem has even, we've done projects in Salem, so a lot of communities we assist in that manner. The FAA does pay us an administrative fee to run this program. We have a pavement maintenance program that's funded by the aviation fuel tax, and the rate for aviation fuel tax for piston-powered aircraft is 5% a gallon, and for jet fuel tax, it's a nickel, and for avgas, which is the general aviation piston-powered aircraft, it's 9 cents a gallon. In 1999 to 2001, we had about $1.9 million in revenue, and in the 2005-2007, we expect $2.3 million worth of revenue. What we do with that is we distribute it to airport improvement projects to maintain the pavement of the runways and all the 62 airports that are in the program right now around the state. And what we've done is we calculate the condition of the pavement, and approximately 40% of the pavements at the runways, taxiways, and apron areas at the airports in the state of Oregon have excellent pavement. 23% have very good pavement, and it's a graduated scale how the engineers come up with what is excellent, good, and our intent is to have all the pavements be in good condition. Once they fall below the good condition, they start to depreciate very rapidly, and they fail. So our intent is to maintain most of the pavement, or all the pavement, at the Oregon airports in a condition that is above good. a trend of what has happened over time with our pavements. You can tell the different colors are the different categories of airports. Category 1 airport, which is the red line, would be an air carrier airport, a carrier like the Redmond or the Port of Portland or the airports. And you can tell that just like every pavement, it has a useful life and it starts to degrade, and then we put some more funding into it and we maintain it, and it improves. So there's a trend, and you can see that from the year 2000 on, our pavement conditions in the state for the airports have continued to increase. So that's a trend that we're very proud of. Issues of 2005, some of the things we'll be looking forward to is that we should be looking up are commercial airline service in the state, a growing general aviation trend in the state, air cargo. Air cargo is the fastest growing segment of the aviation industry right now. Oregon's aviation infrastructure, aviation security, an economic impact study, and then airport ownership.
Well, Charlie, what do you mean there by the economic impact study?
We are in the Madam Chair, we are in the process of updating an economic impact study. What we are doing is we've gotten a grant from the Federal Aviation Administration, and we are going to go out into the communities in the state, and we're going to determine what the positive economic impacts from all the airports are in the community, the direct, the indirect, the induced, and the multiplier effect, positive economic impacts that the aviation industry provides to the economy in the local communities and also in the state.
You have two airports in the state that have grown very much, changed, and have been a part of the economic development of their area. One has been Medford, and the other one has been Redmond. And so are you looking at it, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? Because as those airports were expanded and grew and have been able to provide services, so that has been an attraction for people who have come there. Am I right in that?
It is like, you know, if you build it, they will come. A lot of things, what we will do, Madam Chair, is what we will do is when we go out to those communities, we will take a look at the airports and we will take a snapshot in time of what we have today. We will learn from the community, the Chambers of Commerce, is the leaders in each community, and find out what those trends are of more businesses moving in. Like Ben, for example, has a few factories coming in that are going to build aircraft at that airport. And our economists that we hire will project out in the future what the economic impacts will be in those communities because of the aviation activity occurring at those airports. I don't know if that answered your correction.
Is that part of the economic impact study?
Yes, that is what we will do. We will know, or we will have a figure of what the economic benefits are of the airport to the community, and then we'll compile that as well as to the state. So we will have an overview within the next 12 months of what the positive economic impacts are to the communities from the airports in the state.
And will you do that on the 7 airports that have airline service?
We will, Madam Chair, we will do that at all of the airports in the state. The Port of Portland has just completed their own. We're working with their economic consultant that they hired, their economist, to plug in their information into our report. So we will, yes, we will work with Redmond, we will work with Pendleton, we will work with Medford, we will work with every community that has scheduled airline service as well. It's important for us to know what the positive economic impacts are from the airports in the community. So we will be working with those. We'll do passenger demand surveys at those airports. We will do like it's Dun & Bradstreet, I forget what they call it, but it will check all of the all the industries that work on the airport and have jobs, so that provide jobs and positive economic impacts. We will go to those airports.
Okay, so you have 355 private airports, which you're not going to deal with at all. And no. Then you're going to take the others, all of the others, public airports, and do economic impact study.
Madam Chair, we will have an economic impact study at all of the public use airports. So we have 98 of those. Some we will see even though they're public use airports, they could have very, very little activity at those airports. Some may be just grass strips, and there may not be much activity. But yes, we will take a look at every one of those airports, the 98 public use airports.
Any questions? All right. Okay, go ahead, Charles.
Thank you. Commercial air service. There are seven communities that have scheduled airline service in the state. Portland, Eugene, Pendleton, Medford, Redmond, North Bend, Klamath Falls. Portland is the only airport in the state that has major airline service, flying the larger legacy airlines fly into to PDX, Portland. Klamath Falls, Pendleton, and North Bend are all in jeopardy of losing some of their service by Horizon. What we have in the industry is a trend of the regional airlines that serve communities such as those that are buying the regional jets and taking a lot of the routes that the major legacy airlines have typically had, and letting the regional airlines work with those. So what airlines like Horizon and Calm Air and the other airlines in the country have done is they bought these regional jets. With the regional jets, their stage lengths are longer and they fly greater distances. And so based upon that, some of our communities are kind of priced out of the market because they don't have enough passenger activity to fill up a 70-seat regional jet. So what we have right now is and we see a trend of the smaller communities in danger of losing some of their service.
I just would like to comment for the committee members that North Bend is now down to, I think, three flights a day, and they're flying full. And because of the Bandon Dunes Golf Course, you can see that about half the passengers are carrying golf clubs with them. But the service has been cut back at a time when the passenger demand increased. And that's on top of the private jets that are flying in. So I'm not sure of exactly how Horizon deals with that. In other words, why would they not be interested in an airport where the service is obviously up far above what it's been because of the demand of the golfers? Can you explain that?
Madam Chair, I can give it a shot. What my understanding is that with an airline, they have a limited number of assets, right, a limited number of aircraft. And what they will do is they will use those airplanes and take them to a market that they will get the greatest yield. So what they do is if they can fill up that aircraft more frequently going from a couple of communities, which may not be North Bend, they will take that asset and they will go to those communities. That is the trend that I see throughout the country, to where companies like Chautauqua Airlines, companies like Calm Air, companies like Horizon Airlines, which are the regional airlines, there's a Mesa Airlines, and what they do is they take those assets of the regional jets and they use those in the markets that give the greatest yield. The flights may be full, but the ticket prices are not great enough to where they can get the largest return on their investment. So that's the trend that I see, and the reason that I think that they don't go to communities like North Bend, or they're pulling out of these other communities. And you'll see too with the turboprops that people don't like to fly on, or there's in the news in the past that people don't like to fly on the turboprops. The jets they build, again, have a larger stage length. They go a greater distance, so they won't necessarily go from the North Bend to Portland. They'd rather go from the Portland to Phoenix or something with their asset, because they can get it's business, and they get a greater return on their investment. So producers of turboprops have diminished there's only one firm, I believe it's Saab, that's still producing a turboprop engine, turboprop aircraft, which means a turboprop regional airline aircraft. And they are not building the type of aircraft that we need to fill the holes that we have in our transportation system right now. So it's something that we need to work on. Excuse me.
One of the troubling things about this to me, having been a number of years, 14 or 20, working with economic development, is that we've kind of painted this dream in rural Oregon. If we can just get private people in some type of private industry, or people to invest revenue and their resources in then there's the infrastructure that we can be responsible for and so forth. And down in southwestern, on the southern coast, here we have a man who is building 4 world-class golf courses, investing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. There's no end to beautification of this whole area. And you think, here we have infrastructure that we're losing. So where was the plan that we all talked about? There was something that was built on sand and not on concrete. So just throwing that out, because this is all a part of what is going to make Oregon economically successful. And if we are going on the wrong premise, then now's the time for us to find out. So thank you, Charlie. Are there any other questions by anyone before he goes? All right, continue on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This kind of goes along with what we were just talking about. Alaska's Airlines is looking to be a major player in the West Coast carrier, with Horizon providing the regional service, and we just talked pretty much a lot about that. All currently served communities are expecting changes in the short-term future. Communities without existing service do need assistance. This may assist you and what we were just talking about. The United States Department of Transportation, not the Federal Aviation Administration, but the Department of Transportation, has put together a small community air service development program. And what they do is they offer $20 million a year to encourage aviation scheduled airline services in communities that are in danger of losing service or that do not have service. And it has to be an airport that is not a small hub. Portland is a small hub airport. Seattle is a large hub airport. Chicago is a large hub airport. The Oregon Department of Aviation, we have two plans. We have an A plan and a B plan to work with this. The A plan is to build a consortium with the state of Oregon leading the way, working with the state of Oregon, the state of Washington, and the state of Idaho to put together an air service, a Northwest air service system. What we want to do is get the three states together to find the communities that have the need for an airline service, put together a grant application for these funds, and attract an airline, maybe not an existing airline, maybe a new airline, but another airline that will come in and serve the system that we define as a system that can support capacity or traffic in these communities. There's some challenges working with different states. I'm working with the Department of Aviation Director in Washington and the Department of Aviation Director in Idaho to put together a program. In February, we expect the Department of Transportation to open up the window to to accept applications for these funds. Once you receive funding, you have 3 years to implement the program. So we very much want to do that. But it is a challenge to get three states to work together. The plan B is to come up with an interstate air service development program to put together a grant application and apply to the Department of Transportation for an interstate program. And the idea right now is to get the small communities that don't have air service that we think could have air service and create it like a cluster environment and have a community like Baker City have service to Pendleton, so that Pendleton can have more traveling passengers in their airport. Therefore, they may get a larger airline to come in there. So basically, to break down the state into different geographic regions, identify the communities that can support service on a small scale, 9, 10-seat aircraft, 19-seat aircraft, something, and feed Pendleton, feed Klamath Falls, feed Redmond, instead of feeding Portland. So therefore, we have some traffic going into these airports and then making the Redmonds, making the Klamath Falls, making the Pendletons more attractive to the larger airlines. That's a plan, two plans that we have that we're very excited to work on and we look forward to working on. We think that it's needed. I keep telling people that if the people that occupy the seat that I currently occupy don't do something about this, who will? So we really want to work on that. Air cargo switching gears, is the single fastest growing segment of the air transportation industry in the state of Oregon. We have 22 airports that are served by Federal Express and UPS Express. So those caravans, those small planes that pick up cargo, we have 22 airports in the state that they serve. Oregon Aviation Department is working with the Freight Advisory Committee to find programs, Class A programs that we can identify to help fund to support this kind of activity and build the economy.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Up a little bit on the before the air cargo one, where we're talking about these different plans of getting more air service. I know that Eugene and I believe Redmond, through their Chamber of Commerce, actually bought service by prepaying for a commitment to, in Eugene's case, Horizon, to come in and offer certain direct flights, I guess, to L.A. From Eugene. And I'm not sure the Redmond Airport, if they're going, if it's with SkyWest with Delta or not, but can you maybe elaborate on how those type of partnership programs may be encouraging what you had envisioned through this, like the Northwest Service Initiative?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, yes, what Eugene has done and Redmond are doing is it's a philosophy called ticket banking. And what they have done is they've gone out to the local leaders, the business owners, and the leaders in the community, and purchased, got those communities to commit to purchasing tickets, so many dollars worth of tickets to go to, I believe Eugene goes to Salt Lake City. I'm not sure what Carrie Novick's working on in Redmond, but what they do is they get the communities to commit to purchasing so many seats, so the airline is guaranteed a revenue. They're going to cover their costs and make a profit, and if the aircraft goes out, let's say a month in time, and they've filled the seats without using any of those ticket banks, then that money stays in their ticket bank from those community leaders. But if the aircraft go out short of selling the seats, because when the aircraft door closes, it's a perishable commodity, and the aircraft is gone, and the seat can no longer be sold. If they don't sell enough seats, then the community will pay the number of seats that they were deficient in filling. Typically what's happening, we're seeing, is that the people that buy the tickets use the tickets to go on vacations or make a commitment to go using their tickets for business purposes. So communities like Eugene and Redmond are very, and even I think Klamath Falls may be working on that, they're very proactive in finding solutions to provide air service to their communities.
Great. Continue on.
Thank you. Finish with the air cargo. Interesting changes. The Airbus 380, just a sidebar here with the Airbus 380, has just been released. This is one of the trends in cargo activity. Cargo activity is going to triple in the next 10 years. So currently what we have right now, it's going to triple within the next 10 years. This Airbus that has just been unveiled can seat up to 840 passengers. So that's going to be, can you imagine 840 passengers pulling into the terminal at Port of Portland all at one time? In the United States, the only companies that have placed orders for these aircraft is UPS and Federal Express. So it's quite an aircraft. But the trend there is the people that have bought them, the businesses that have bought them, are the cargo carriers. The next segment of the aviation industry is the general aviation side of the world. And the general aviation side, the business is where the business travelers are choosing general aviation over the airline transportation. There are a couple new business models that have been the fractional ownership business program, is where you don't have to purchase your aircraft anymore. You share the cost with other people and you just use it when you need it. Second thing coming out is there's an Eclipse jet. It's a six-seat jet that's coming out that will only cost $1.3 million. It's quite a bit less expensive than all of the other citations and business jets that are currently out there that run $10 to $15 to $20 million. At general aviation airports, they have more options. They can fly into locations that are closer to their destinations. They have their own schedules, and obviously there's less delays, and it is more convenient. Another thing we do at the aviation department is we keep our finger on the aviation security since 9/11. We work with the Transportation Security Administration. Every Monday at noon, all of the airport managers in the state of Oregon have a conference call with the TSA, and we talk about security issues that may be happening, as well as other airport management issues that occur. We work with the National Association of State Aviation Officials to find out if anything is pressing, anything is occurring on the security front, so we stay in tune and connected to those people. We work with the Airplane Owners and Pilots Associations to form airport watch programs so that the people that use the airport, the people that are familiar with the airports, have a watch program at those airports. We also work with the American Association of Airport Executives to keep keep up to speed with the security at the airports in the state. The economic impact study, we mentioned earlier, it'll be completed within the next 12 months, and we're completing that at the same time we're updating the state airport system plan. This is a chart or a map of the geographic areas that we're going to break down. What we're going to do is we're going to hold regional planning meetings. We're going to invite the local community leaders, the business leaders, the airport users to a central geographic region with several airports. So we don't have to travel to all those communities, and all those community leaders don't have to travel to us. So we're going to hold those meetings throughout the state, and we're going to learn what is that happening in their communities. We're going to get that information from them, and then we're going to go out to their communities to dig up more information. And then we're going to put together an update for the state system plan and the economic impact study.
Charlie, you're familiar with the project that's being planned at the North Bend Airport. That's been worked on for quite a while. They've done a master plan. It came through ERT, through the Governor's Solutions Team. They've gotten all their ducks in a row. I understand that it's been endorsed by the governor and by ODOT and by a number of people. Have you been involved in that at all?
Madam Chair, I personally have not been involved with that. I'm aware that it is an attempt to get a new terminal building that is desperately needed at that airport. Ann Crook has worked on that. Ron Rendy worked on that some. And I know it is in the works, and I know that we encourage it and promote it. The current terminal building that they have is, you know, quite old, and it needs to be replaced. And it would assist the traveling public for, you know, what you alluded to with the abandoned dunes golf course and the growth that is expected to occur with the traveling public in Coos Bay.
Well, I think that it is inadequate for the traveling public. But I think back to your comments about general aviation. Sometimes there are 32 Learjets there. We have no planning for that kind of activity, and also we have no building. And people that are bringing in Learjets and going to abandoned dunes are accustomed to a general aviation building and a little bit better service than we are able to offer in that part of the world, because they go from Pebble Beach to the Southern California and then up. And of course, they are coming. People are coming worldwide, and so. But I just wondered if you knew about that, because I wondered what your opinion was, if they're working in the right direction. Because if people are doing a lot on their own, that helps the department. In other words, if they're working to get their own plans, have brought people in, get people to sign off on it, declaration of cooperation, those kinds of things, wouldn't you agree that that is a good way for the department to watch communities contribute to their own success?
Madam Chair, that is absolutely, I agree with that completely. The public-private partnerships that are needed at the airports, with the trend that I indicated earlier with the general aviation side of the world flying the fractional ownership jets, the people that have, that are affluent enough to fly into these places with their jets, Bandon Dunes is a big draw, and it's going to continue to grow. Typically what we have for that side of the world, the private industry has typically put together what they call them is fixed based operations. It's a place where the private aircraft owner can take his aircraft when he lands. It's the gas station for those guys. They're typically very first class, high, class A locations, class A places. When you go in, you land there, you open up your doors, they pull out the red carpet, they take care of you like you've never been taken care of before. That is what is needed at Coos Bay, and you will find that that will happen, because as the traffic is increasing, there is somebody out there that will see that there is a market there and a way to make a profit doing that. And I agree with what you said.
Okay. All right.
And that concludes my testimony.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just following up on the Airbus 380. I'm familiar with the C-5 Galaxy. Can you give me some perspective as to how big this Airbus is? Does it come into the same size as the C-5? Or is it?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Brzezinski, this is quite a bit larger. It can operate out of the same off the same airports. Airbus is phenomenal about building aircraft that can operate off of fields that are currently in existence. It's bigger than what we've seen before. I mean, this is the leader right now as far as size.
I have one quick question about that. Is it built by Boeing?
Madam Chair, no. It is an Airbus built in Europe.
In Europe.
Yes.
Okay. Senator Starr is right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very simple general question. What does it take to have your own airstrip? I mean, if you just have enough land, you can, put some gravel down and fly your private plane in and off your own land. Is that as easy, as simple as it is?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, that is, in the state of Oregon, if you have the land, you call us, and we will come out and look at your property and make sure that it is indeed a safe airstrip. You're not trying to build your airstrip that has trees way too close. But as far as owning your own property, yes, you can. I mean, we have, I believe, 355 of those private strips that somebody owned the property, and they decided to put a landing strip on it, and they fly in there on it's their ranch that they fly into. So, and that's pretty much the trend throughout the country.
Senator Metz.
Just follow up with Senator Starr said, have you had any significant issues with the glide slope for people with private airports with people with adjoining properties and growing trees and having houses and having, because I've had those in the past, complaints about from both ends about someone's interfered on my personal airstrip because they are putting hazards up in the glide slope and vice versa.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzger, typically what happens is people that want to put a landing strip on their own property have adequate enough property that they're not going to be impacted by the neighbors. But it does happen that they get a landing strip out there. It's licensed and registered through our office, and then something happens to where the adjoining property might have sold something for a cell phone tower or something like that. In the past, we would triangulate those and locate those using the maps. But today we have computer programs that all we do is we put out the longitude and the latitude and the coordinates of it, and we can tell whether it is close to an airport or not. And if it is close to an airport that would violate an approach or departure path, then we would not recommend that they build the cell phone tower or whatever structure that they want there. So we do have someone in our office that's what they do.
Interesting.
All right. Charlie, thank you very much for being here today. Your presentation's been very, very interesting. And I did not realize that you had 355 people flying in to home every night.
Thank you.
All right. I want to just kind of refresh some memories here that quite a while back, let me see, 1990 to 2000, there was this dry decade of people trying to get money for roads and bridges in Oregon. I'm looking back here at Paul Mathis, correct me if I'm wrong, this decade of effort that many good people who were here, some from my part of the world, trying to help ODOT get money to address the needs that Oregon had as Oregon continued to grow and get more people. And then we had some bright people to come along, and I lift Senator Starr as one of those, and certainly Senator Metzger, who were able to find ways, and through negotiation and cooperation and funding for the OTIA packages. And so I think today what I'd like very much is to have an update on where we are with our bridges. We've heard and read a lot about the kind of work that's going on, and all of us have experienced a little bit of delay along our travels. And so today I presume that Director Bruce Warner was going to join us, and Region 3 Manager Paul Mathis. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Warner, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. And with me today is Paul Mather, our Region 3 manager. And my job today is really to introduce Paul and set the stage for what we want to talk about today. My understanding is, again, as you point out, you want to talk a little bit about how we're doing on bridges. And one of the important pieces of work we've been doing is again, trying to get the best information we can in terms of making decisions whether to repair, replace, or do nothing with particular bridges in a system. And Paul is somebody that I tasked before the last session to really take a hold of the entire program and come up with a plan of attack to address the failing bridges on the state highway system. And as you point out, the legislature did pass the Oregon Transportation Investment Act 3, which a major portion of that funding was to go to replace bridges failing that are failing on the important state freight routes around the state of Oregon. And as part of our effort to make sure that we're expending the dollars in the most efficient and effective manner, we asked Oregon State University to do some research for us in terms of looking at this problem to make sure that, again, we did have the best information possible. What I'd like to do is ask Paul to give you a bit of the reasons, first off, the reasons for and the objectives of the study, talk a little bit about its findings and conclusions, and really outline for you some of the things that we're doing with the information we've received, as well as other information we've gathered as we start doing field work on all of these bridges, to allow us to meet your expectations of getting that state freight route system, the primary rate freight route system, free from restrictions against trucking. And then finally, the other thing is to, again, just let you know how we're utilizing this information to make decisions on individual bridges to make sure that they're most cost-effectively done and that we're not spending any money that we don't have to move forward in this program. So if I could, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Mather right now and have him go through the presentation, and we'd both be available for questions during and after the presentation.
Director Warner, you've heard, if you believe that, I'll sell you a bridge in Florida. Well, your Director Mathis didn't sell me a bridge, but he sold me two roads. How's that? So I think he's pretty good guy to sell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Director Warner said, let me just give me a brief update on the program. Start we just kind of turn the clocks back to about a year ago when we first started making presentations to the legislature about our bridge problems. We put together a bridge options report, is what we called it, to talk about the different options that we had to deal with our bridge problem. In that report, we documented the economic impacts of our bridge failures and the impacts that they'll have on communities. In the economic impacts, we talked about severe impacts that would result in potentially 88,000 jobs lost and a potential $123 billion impact on the economy between now and 2025. On the community side, we talked about detours, forcing trucks off of freight routes, off of the interstates, and through communities, downtowns, past schools, through neighborhoods, and the impact that those are going to have on the communities and livability in Oregon. In the report, we identified key routes that we could secure for the next 20 years for freight. There was a strategic look at our problem. The overall report identified a $4.7 billion in bridges, but we really took a strategic look at where the most important routes, most important bridges were, and we identified those and secured those for 20 years. The map there on the chart shows our kind of our five-stage approach that we took to the strategic approach that we took to solving the problem. Focused really on the interstate system, I-5 and I-84 being the backbone for Oregon's economy. But as you'll notice, one of the key things in there, the blue route there, what we call Stage 1, is Highway 97, Highway 26 over Mount Hood, Highway 20 through Central Oregon to Ontario, is really where we needed to start solving the bridge problem, just to provide an immediate relief for a north-south, east-west connection that connected the economic engine of the state, Portland, Willamette Valley. Low-cost option that we could implement right away. Today, that corridor is under construction. We have over 20 bridge projects in that corridor under construction. Several of those are due to be completed this summer, and all of them will be wrapped up by next spring. By having this stage completed and secured, then we're able to move aggressively onto the interstate system and trucks, over-dimensional trucks, as overweight trucks, I have an alternative route to use rather than the construction that will happen on the interstate system. Once that backbone on the interstate is complete, then the green and yellow routes on there represent kind of connections into other economic important areas in the state, including ports on the coast and through eastern Oregon, to make connections to that backbone of the interstate. Another thing in the report that we implemented was a corridor approach to our bridge problem. In the past, we've really looked at our bridge problem as ranking bridges from the worst to the best, and really just started down that list. And many times, as you may have addressed the top 10 worst bridges in the state, you could still end up with the same number of corridors restricted, because the bridge right next to one was the 11th or the 12th or the 15th worst bridge on the list that didn't get addressed, and in essence, the corridor that freight relies on remains restricted. So we really looked at this from a corridor approach, which as we implement this may start looking a little different to users of the system, where we may have some very poor bridges that don't get addressed or on less freight-sensitive routes as we focus on ones that are more freight important.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Before we go far, I was wondering if you could just walk us through again what the color code is. I understand the blue represents the two U.S. highways, 97 and 20. The brown is Interstate 84 and looks like part of 80 of I-5. The red, looks like the other part, the southern part of I-5, what's the difference between the red and the brown, if there is any?
Madam Chair, Senator Przanski, I just quickly run through all of them. As I went through the blue, the stage one, and you articulated the stage two very well, but the Highway 58 is also part of stage two. And stage three is the red, which is really from the Highway 58 junction and I-5 south to California. We divided I-5 up into two different segments just because of the volume of work in that segment. The amount of work that we're doing in the southern portion of I-5 equals to all of that on the remainder of the interstate system, so there's a very intense work on that piece of the interstate. And also thought, before we start on that, we needed, another route to secure for freight traffic over 5897, for example, for them to have that secured before we started work on that southern portion of I-5. The remainder of those, the stage four, is in the yellow that we, again, start building freight routes off of that backbone. The distinction between 4 and 5 is you get to the green. We're trying to stretch the dollars as far as we could go. Stages 1 through 4 secure all those routes for essentially any load, what we call weight table 5, but any load with a heavy piece of machinery, a transformer, anything that needs to be hauled in the highway system. What's different about the green, it covers just 105-pound loads, or the continuous trip permit loads, the doubles, the triples, and so forth. That handles about 90-some percent of the truck traffic, but not that 1 or 2% that's the super heavy loads that are in the weight table 5. Again, try to stretch our dollars as far as we can. So that's just the distinction between 4 and 5 that are out there.
Thank you.
As we moved into this, again, we're still back 2 years ago, and we're thinking about the bridge problem and trying to understand the bridge problem that we have. Those of us working out in the field and dealing with the bridge problems that we saw out there, we were using the national models that are out there for us to analyze these bridges and determine the weight that's allowed on those. And we were watching trucks, and we were watching cracks grow or not grow on the different bridges that we were monitoring. And in a lot of cases, they weren't correlating with what our experiences were in the field and what the national models were saying. So we knew we needed more information about these bridges. We knew we were going to be managing a large inventory of these for a number of years, and we needed to be smarter about those. And we need to ensure ourselves that we were making decisions in the public's best interest for safety. We asked Oregon State to conduct a study to help us with that. They did a 2-year study for us, looking at 4 bridges that are existing on our system, as well as beams in their laboratory, where they actually broke some beams and took measurements as they did. But the objectives of this study were to help us determine if there's extra strength in these beams that we weren't calculated by the national standards that we were using, help us determine if there's extra life in these beams that we haven't been able to quantify, and again, just have a better management tool for us as we move forward. Some of the key findings as they went through their study, they confirmed that we do have a bridge problem and these bridges are failing, but they confirmed that there is more strength than what we had been allowing for in the national models that we were using. Probably the most important finding that they had is they found for us that there was not going to be a catastrophic failure of these bridges. They weren't going to fail suddenly. We were going to have warning and be able to detect the failure of the bridge before they actually failed. Currently, we're in the process of refining these studies so we can implement those. Our timeline for that is we're just about complete with getting the model and calibrating it for use. We should be, by the first part of February, we're a couple weeks behind schedule, but by the first part of February, we should be able to use the model in a Longham form and then have it automated by about 6 months from now, or about September. This new technology is going to help us manage our bridges, not just the ones that are left out there, but also the ones that are part of the 5 stages that I talked about before. During the last 2 years, since the last legislative session, there's been a lot of new information that's been collected. What I just talked about with the Oregon State study is one piece. We've also prepared what we call baseline reports on each one of these bridges. The information that we presented last session was based on information we had on file. During the last 2 years, we've gone out and performed a study in every one of the 365 bridges that are in the program. Mostly from the engineering standpoint, so we could write some scopes of work for the consultants that actually do work on them, but also from a permitting and environmental standpoint, understand the environmental permits and parameters around each one of these permits so we could expedite the permitting process.
Paul, one of the things that concerns me always is the public's perception of what we're doing and the transparency that we all need. And has there been a real good effort by the department to show that explaining the OSU study and the difference in the way I've seen one press release, I know, in the paper. But I do think, I just want to point this up right now, I do think it's extremely important that we always, when we find things are better or worse or whatever, that we are transparent in our explanation. Because I think once you inform the public, actually this was a good thing.
Right.
This was a very positive thing, but it was different than we had thought. So I just want to kind of point that out.
Good. Thank you.
So we've had a lot of additional information that has been collected over the last 2 years. So how to apply this new information that we have, not only from the Oregon State study, but from the baseline reports and other things that we've accumulated. As I said, we've been very aggressive in getting stage one underway just to secure a north-south, east-west connection in the state. And the importance that has for the economy of the state. So we focused our applying this new information to stages 2 through 5, which really represents 90% of the program anyway. So as we went through and applied the baseline reports, the Oregon State study, and the input that we had from different communities, some of the bridges we found needed no work. While that was a fairly small amount, but we had them in, for example, for repair. As we looked at them from the baseline reports and from the Oregon State study, there were some that fell out and actually didn't need any work. There was a couple of bridges that we actually could remove from the list. As we got in, again, did the baseline reports, we found that the bridge was over a rail line that's been abandoned, has been over a road that's been abandoned, that we actually didn't need the bridge there in the first place. We were actually able to remove the bridge as part of the project. Many of the bridges have moved from the replace category to the repair category. So again, using the Oregon State study and using the baseline reports, we had enough information to be confident that we're able to do repairs and secure that bridge and that route for the next 20 years. Some of the bridges, even with this new information, still stayed in the replace category. Some of them for bridge reasons and structural reasons, but some of them, as I illustrate there in the blue box, there's some safety concerns with a particular bridge, where there's low clearance, where bridge or trucks have hit them numerous times, or sight distance concerns. Some of the bridges are key parts to STIP projects, widening I-5 through Salem, for example. Some of those bridges are key to that project and other STIP projects around the state. In some cases, we have, especially in the interstate, we have parallel structures. We have one bridge that needs to be replaced, and the neighboring bridge needs to be repaired. By the time you mobilize a contractor, build a detour bridge, get all the forces mobilized to replace that one bridge and repair the other, for a very nominal increase in cost, you can actually repair both bridges at the same time. We did a design-build contract and put that in as an option for one bridge in southern Oregon, and actually found for about a $4 or $5 million bridge, it cost us about $800,000 more to do the replacement above what the repair costs were, as we went out with a competitive bid process to validate our assumptions. And then in some cases, it's not the deck girders that are causing the only problem with the bridge. There's footings, there's columns, there are other elements of the bridge that are also equally as important that are driving it. So once you get through that sort, as we go through, you know, all the bridges in stages 2 through 5, there's still another set of bridges that we can't be conclusive about what our recommendation at this point is. We need to wait till the model is calibrated, and we need to do more analysis. And we've set those aside until we've got the model, the OSU model, completely calibrated, and we can run those through those analysis. Our challenge is to keep the momentum of this program is going. As you know, we've hired a program management firm and have mobilized a lot of resources within the department and within the consulting and contracting industry, and we need to keep the momentum of the program going to meet the objectives of the program, not just from a bridge standpoint, but from an economic job creation standpoint. So we've tried to go through and apply this new information through stages 2 through 5, and where we can be certain about the scope of the work, whether it's repair or replace, keep those projects kind of on the assembly line, in the pipeline, moving forward to keep the momentum of the program going. With that, I can take questions.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I think that's, while we read a lot in the paper and see a lot on the roads, I think it's good for us to just kind of have a little summary right now while we're looking at things. I don't want us to get off track here, but I do want to ask you a question. The freight routes, you're causing me lots of grief, so I thought I'd just share with you that perhaps you can give some thought to how you might best come back at some future time and talk with us about how you are determining which one of those routes. Should I have had you do that today? If I should have, I'm remiss in not. But that is something that is not very popular. I don't know about other districts, but I think that we need to have some a little better understanding, and certainly I do as chair of transportation. I'm getting lots of requests as to why you've chosen the route you've chosen, and also the comment at the end that we don't like it. So if you'd help me with that. Let's open to questions on bridges, though. Senator Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm most interested in a couple of things, but mostly more information, a little more detailed information. This is pretty sketchy, and this is the same stuff you gave us a couple of months ago, and I expected a little bit more detail here, quite frankly. I was expecting that you'd have your bridge options report reissued by now. You can comment on where you are in that process. I believe you're updating that. I was hopeful that I'd get that copy this morning rather than the same information we had a couple of months ago. To that end, though, I'd like more detail about how the bridges had moved in your page 7 of your presentation. You know, it's the same graph you showed us before, but I'd like numbers of bridges on each category. How many bridges are now no work? How many bridges have been removed? How many bridges have you downgraded from replace to repair? And what's the associated savings, and how many more bridges are we going to be able to fix going forward in a proposed stage 6, perhaps, or 7 even? Those are the kinds of details that I'd be interested in hearing from the department. You know, we're looking at getting more bang from our transportation buck, I can see, in this process, and be interested to know, you know, is there an ability to provide more links to the coast? You know, you look at the all the stage 1 through 5, and I think you only got four freight routes to the coast. Obviously, I think there's a need there, and also on 101, I think there's some pretty significant needs in that region as well. So those are the kinds of things that I hope that you can come back to this committee at some future time and give us really some more meat on these bones. I'd appreciate that.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, yes, as I testified to the Interim Committee in December, this is basically the same information I gave then. I'd hope to have our updated bridge options report ready at this time. I have a draft of the report that's out to our stakeholder committee for review. We still have the detailed information that you illustrated with the bridge by bridge, what category they've moved into. We're still verifying bridges into the different categories. We have a lot of the work done, but we're down to some of the need details that we're trying to work through. I'm hoping that by March that we're able to have that detailed new cost estimates, new numbers with each one of these things that we can publish in that updated bridge options report, and we'll be able to give you that information.
And just to follow up, and it's fair too to just say, you know, we're still working on it. We don't know all the details for sure, but this is where we are in the process. I mean, I understand a lot of, you know, the utilization of the OSU model and all that may take some time to kind of get it up and running, and especially the automated portion of it. I know you're working hard and getting stuff out the door, and so this is a little bit of extra work, so I understand that, but I'm really interested in kind of a little bit more detail.
Director Warner, would you like to come in?
Madam Chair, I guess in answer to your first question, I would be glad to come back to you and talk about the differences between the freight routes identified on the map that you saw that outlined as stages 1 through 5 of the critical freight routes that you asked us to harden as part of the OTIA 3 funding package. But we do have an ongoing effort also, which I think is what you're talking about. We're trying to identify all of the routes in the state that are important for movement of freight. And it could be some of them are definitely not on that map, and we want to make sure that's the case, because what we want to do is we want to also work with the communities in those areas in a way to identify those areas where we want to allow increased development which means increased densities, more access, and more congestion. But we also want to do it with our eyes wide open in terms of making sure that those routes, as we allow those communities to grow economically, also keep in mind the importance of moving freight through those areas. And so there is definitely a lot of consternation and concern. I think Senator Prozanski knows one in his district, Highway 126, which is one of those that people are very concerned about. And so we would love to come back and give you a briefing on that work, because that is another effort of work that probably will be completed about summer of this year. But the intent is for planning purposes and for the purposes of really redevelopment of some of the downtown and the community areas to provide other tools for cities and counties to essentially encourage the development to occur in the right way and to allow us to be more lenient, frankly, in the way we approach access and development in those areas. So we'd love to come back, and I think you probably would like a more detailed discussion on that. And I also understand there's a few folks looking at legislation to make sure that, again, it's clear in terms from that perspective what is a freight route and what isn't, if I'm being responsive to your needs.
That's true.
So we can work with your administrator and maybe get on the schedule to come back with that one, too.
That's great.
If I could, Madam Chair, just one other thing I don't want to forget, which I think is very important. I think Paul stated it, but didn't state it quite as strong as I would, is that when you look at this OSU study, one of the major reasons we had this done is because when you looked at the nationally accepted models, what you use to calculate the remaining strength in these bridges, there were a number of bridges where the calculation showed that the structure could not hold itself up, let alone take any additional truck loads. And so this is the model by which our federal government partner says you need to rate your bridges. And the answer to that is either you restrict all trucks immediately from those bridges, or do the repairs immediately while you're posting and remove those trucks. We believe that our process of managing, looking at the bridges, because we know them very intimately, monitoring the cracks, monitoring the loads, and if they started to grow, then start to do increasingly more detail or more restrictive truck loadings, was prudent and did not risk put the public at risk. This analysis really did demonstrate there is latent capacity in those bridges, and our plan to essentially that allowed trucks to remain on the bridge, maybe only at 80,000 pounds, but do continuous monitoring, was prudent and allows us to get to these stages 1 through 5 over the next few years with no risk to the public, which is what we believe. But this allowed us and our federal government partners to nod and say we were heading the right way, which I think is very, very important and part of this work.
Yes, and to restrict all trucks is just economically devastating to private companies that are trying to move that freight.
Exactly.
Other questions? All right. Well, thank you very much, and we'll look forward to your coming back, and we'll have some more detail in a report and talk about freight and freight routes particularly. We really need to have those answers for us. So, very good. All right. Members of the committee, we will be going on the road February the 11th. And the trip will take us down to North Bend, Coos Bay area. We will hear from the International Port of Coos Bay on both rail and marine. And also you'll get a briefing on the expansion of the airport project there. Judith is working on all the details, so we'll get to you, but be sure you get February the 11th on your schedule so that we'll be down there.
Do we have times at this point as to when the committee would be meeting on that day?
I think that we would be, what I would like to do is make a stop at the Port of Umpqua there in Reedsport on our way down, so that those of you who are not familiar with the small port there, and to meet the port director, and then to go on in. So there would probably be a presentation prior to lunch, and have lunch and a presentation afterward, and then head back. We are getting invitations from that part of the world, dinner at Bandon Dunes and those kinds of things. However, I told them that you were a working committee and you probably needed to get back. So But Judith is working on the details and be happy to give them to you. And thank everybody for being here today. And it was a good meeting. And if there's no other business to come before this body, I'll call the meeting adjourned.